This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by Hartford Healthcare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You're encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information, and we're going to answer all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning for a live program. And I have an outstanding guest that I've been waiting to get onto the program. Our guest today will be Dr. Cherish Smith. Dr. Smith is a medical doctor. She is a doctor who specializes in neuropsychiatry. And her job primarily is as director of the Memory Care Center at Hartford Healthcare. Dr. Smith is an expert in memory care, specifically the diagnosis and treatment of cognitive impairment, mild cognitive impairment, dementias. So we're going to have an extended conversation with her about some of the most recent treatments of dementia. We're going to talk about what it's like to go to the memory center, what are the tests they administer, and we're going to talk about, you know, if needed, how to get in touch with her and her group. They're located right here in Wethersfield, Connecticut, and it's an outstanding group. I can tell you just from the standpoint of patients that I've referred over there, I've heard nothing but great feedback in regard to Dr. Smith and her staff. We're going to be talking about some medical updates. And as always, if you have questions for me, you can reach me at info@alessimd.com. This day in medicine, December 7th, 1967, Dr. Adrian Kantrowitz performed the world's second heart transplant and the first one performed in the United States. Now, we all remember the heart transplant performed by Dr. Christian Barnard in South Africa. But Dr. Kantrowitz was working at Maimonides Medical Center in Brooklyn, New York, and he's a cardiac surgeon. And he invented actually the first intra-aortic balloon pump, something that's used very commonly in cardiac surgery. He did a lot of work in perfecting the heart-lung machine that's still used. And he actually put together one of the first pacemakers. It was a pacemaker that was implanted in the heart and could be regulated from the outside. Now, Dr. Kantrowitz went ahead and on this day in 1967 performed the first heart transplant in this country. And it was successful from the standpoint that the patient lived for a limited period of time. Dr. Kantrowitz went on record as saying he felt that it was a failure because he could not prolong any further. And he was hopeful that it was going to be the answer. Obviously, heart transplants have advanced a great deal since 1967. Dr. Kantrowitz died in 2008. So very interesting, a brilliant mind. Actually, he wanted to become a neurosurgeon. But when he came back from the war, from World War II, there were limited spots for training and then went into cardiac surgery and really became a leader in the field of cardiac surgery. A few things to note. You know, we're hearing a lot about blood tests for cancer. And I don't know if folks have heard about it, but there are several articles published about what is called the Galleri blood test, spelled G-A-L-L-E-R-I. And this is a blood test that you can do it. They send you a kit. You have your blood drawn and it's sent off. And it looks for over 50 forms of cancer. And it can detect, it claims that it can detect cancer before you're symptomatic. And there are a lot of cases of it that have been reported. Now, this is FDA approved. It has been tested. And it's interesting how they do this. So in addition to your routine screening, right, we go for colonoscopy, getting CT scans of the lung, especially if you're a smoker, mammography. Those are single cancer screens. We call those single screens. What happens with this test is it detects in your blood a cancer signal. They call it a signal, but it's actually a DNA fingerprint. So when you have cancer cells, they emit DNA into the bloodstream. And this test that has been devised can pick up on these. And as I said, it's over 50 blood tests. The story I read about was actually a senior vice president for the Dallas Cowboys did the test and found out that he had stage 2 throat cancer and was asymptomatic. So I think one of the questions here is looking at the false positives. So when you do single screening tests, there's about a 10% false positive rate. So something they might think is cancer, and then later and subsequently you find that it wasn't cancer. It was a benign condition. The false positive rate with this, remember that single test screen is 10%. The Galleri test is 0.5%. So half of 1% false positives. So when it detects something, it's very likely that it's there and very specific and would lead to a patient contacting their physician and now focusing on that potential cancer diagnosis. This is a huge breakthrough, and there have been several companies working on it. Now, the hitch here is it's expensive. It's $949 to do the test, and they are working. There is a bill in Congress called the Multi-Cancer Early Detection Screening Bill, and it actually passed the House Committee 38-0. So it's being investigated. The American Cancer Society Action Network is actually supportive of this test. I think it's something we're going to be hearing more and more about. They have a very expansive website if you'd like to go to it. Again, it's G-A-L-L-E-R-I, and it's put together by a group called GRAIL, G-R-A-I-L, which is a Silicon Valley company. Many of you are also hearing about Anthem. Blue Cross Blue Shield have reversed their decision on putting a time limit on anesthesia. So, and they have backpedaled on this. So it's kind of hard to believe that if you go to have an operation, that it's potential, and it was only in Missouri, New York, and Connecticut. I don't know why they singled us out, but it's hard to believe that they will only pay for part of the anesthesia and the rest of the time it's on you, the patient. So they backpedaled quite a bit and said this wasn't the case, we're not doing this. But actually what they were doing was basing their payment on physician work time values. Now, this is a value published by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And again, remember, there's a lot going on with the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services with a new administration, and we need to watch what is going on for better or worse. But they were using this physician work time value as a metric for anesthesia limits. So let me explain. If the physician work time value said taking your gallbladder out should take 30 minutes and yours took 60 minutes, they would only pay for anesthesia based on the 30 minutes. So that was their ploy to cut back, again, to cut back what they pay, and then you're on the hook for the other 30 minutes of anesthesia. For taking out a gallbladder, a physician, whether it takes 30 minutes, 60 minutes, or 2 hours, they get the same amount of money. But with anesthesia, it is time-based. So what they're saying here is that you only get enough anesthesia based on the amount of time allotted to do that procedure, which is ridiculous and dangerous. So fortunately, they withdrew that new caveat that some genius at Anthem thought up as a way, again, to put more cost onto patients. And again, it's another sign that our system here in America, our healthcare delivery system, is broken. We're the best in the world at taking care of patients, of medical treatment, but delivering that treatment is just awful. And that's a clear sign of it. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back with my guest. She's going to be with us for the whole 45 minutes, and I've really been looking forward to it. My guest is going to be Dr. Cherish Smith, a neuropsychiatrist at Hartford Healthcare. If you wish to reach out to me with questions while we are live on the air, you can do that by going to info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning. And my guest today is Dr. Cherish Smith. Dr. Smith is a medical doctor. She is a psychiatrist specializing in neuropsychiatry, and she is director of the Memory Care Center at Hartford Hospital, actually located in Wethersfield, Connecticut. Cherish, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tony. Thanks for having me. How are you?
Okay. Let's talk a little bit. Can you explain to our listeners a little bit about your background and how you got into the field of neuropsychiatry?
Yeah, sure. So I, like you said, I'm a psychiatrist. I did my residency in psychiatry in at SUNY Downstate in New York City. And it was during my time there when I was a resident being consulted for a patient that ultimately ended up having autoimmune encephalitis. I realized that, you know, there was just such a juxtaposition between neurology and psychiatry, and, you know, it works together. We cannot separate the brain from the mind, right? And ultimately, I decided that I wanted to get some more education in the background of neurology. And under the United Council of Neurological Subspecialties, the training is actually called Behavioral Neurology and Neuropsychiatry. And in doing that fellowship at the University of Florida is where I got more exposure to the area of cognitive disorders, which is, you know, my area of specialty at this point.
So when we talk about this, when a patient comes to a place like the Memory Care Center, what's it like for them? What can they expect when they're seeing a neuropsychiatrist?
Yeah, so at our clinic at the Memory Care Center, we have this three-visit model where at the first visit, patients and their loved ones typically come with a variety of cognitive impairments, right? So it could be language difficulties, memory problems, perceptual disturbances. So we get to know each other at the first visit. They explain what their problems are. I like to ask the question, you know, what are your expectations? And then as we understand the expectations and as we build that therapeutic alliance and based on what the presenting concern is, we would do certain diagnostic tests, right? And they typically would involve us doing a cognitive screening test to see where patients are at that point in time. And if needed, then we would do further diagnostic evaluation, which might include an MRI, blood work, and even more extensive cognitive testing via our neuropsychologists. And that's like about a three-hour battery of cognitive testing. And then at the second or third visit, that's when we typically would meet to discuss the results of these tests that we did.
So what's the most common complaint when someone comes to see you walking in the door? I mean, there are a variety of complaints, I'm sure, but yeah. What's the most common one that people seek out your assistance for?
So most common complaint would be short-term memory loss.
And
typically what they walk through the door asking for help with.
Okay. And when they refer to short-term memory loss, What are they thinking of? Is it names? Is it losing things? What prompts somebody typically to show up at your clinic?
Yeah, a lot of times it's difficulties with names, but also we do realize that people are forgetting recent conversations or activities. I also have patients saying things like, I'm so reliant on note making. I need to write everything down, otherwise I'm going to forget it. They also might say things like, I'm dependent on my phone, the calendar, like I can't be without my calendar. So that's typically what I see when they come into the office.
Do people come to you soon enough, in the sense that there are things that you can do, or does it take a long time for people to get to see you? You know what I mean by the frustration from your standpoint? If they had gotten here earlier, I might have been able to do something. Do people get to you soon enough in general?
I believe that they do. I think especially in the advent of all the information that is going on about especially Alzheimer's disease and this early intervention. So a lot of times I do have patients coming in the very beginning stages, which is great because we do have a lot of advancements now in this field that could, you know, help patients at earlier stages. And I do have, I think in the advent of 23andMe and all these genetic tests, I have a lot of patients coming in saying, I have a family history of Alzheimer's disease and I'm okay for now, but I just want to see like where things are. So I do get a lot of our patients coming in very early on, and it's pretty good when it comes to us intervening early enough.
You know, when you went over the complaints that people present with, I could already envision many of our listeners now saying, wait a second, I have to rely on my calendar and I have to make notes.
Right.
How do you discern what's normal aging change from something mm-hmm. that's pathologic?
Right. And that's a really, really good question. And I like to also tap into my psychiatry skills. And I highlight this in this era of technology, right? We have all learned this or have this learned helplessness where most of us are reliant on our smart devices. And I like to provide education on normal aging and explain that as we get older, things will slow down a bit, right? The processing speed slows down, and that reliance on electronic devices, there is a lot of normalcy to it. Now, where we start to seep into pathology is if we are continuing to decline over time and it's starting to affect our activities of daily living. So is it so declined that we're constantly forgetting the stove on, we're flooding out the apartments constantly, are we driving and getting lost? That's when it starts to become more of a pathology and less of a normal aging process.
You mentioned the neuropsychometric testing. I assume that that's pretty key to quantifying what's going on.
It definitely is. It's great to, it helps us establish a baseline. The tests that are administered, they usually help with assuming someone's pre-morbid level of functioning and then really putting together the information in real time and comparing someone's pre-morbid abilities to where they are today. So it's really, really gold standard and just really helpful for diagnostic clarification.
Excellent. Excellent. Listen, we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Cherish Smith. Today, we're discussing cognitive changes, memory changes, dementia. In the second half of the program, we're going to zoom in a little bit on the specifics and the specific types of dementia that Dr. Smith works with, and more importantly, some of the new treatments that are out there. If you have questions for me, you could reach me at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and my guest today is Dr. Cherish Smith. She is director of the Memory Care Center, and she is a neuropsychiatrist working with patients with dementia and, obviously, difficulties with memory. If you wish to reach out to Dr. Smith, the phone number for the Memory Care Center is 860-545-7550. Cherish, getting back to what we were talking about in terms of working up a patient and trying to focus down on where their memory difficulty is. You mentioned the neuropsychometric testing, but also more advanced testing such as an MRI. How often does the MRI play a role in working this up?
So, you know, I guess because we are a specialized clinic, we do order MRIs a lot more often than your average PCP or, you know, general neurology, right, in terms of focusing more so on the memory part of the brain. It's pretty often that I order it once I see that someone is at risk for or their symptoms are highly suggestive of specifically an Alzheimer's disease process or something neurodegenerative. So the specialized MRI that we tend to do is something called a NeuroQuant, which allows us to use a special software that measures the volume of the brain. Specifically, we focus on the hippocampal volumetrics because what we found is that the hippocampi tend to be often affected in the Alzheimer's disease process. But in diagnosing or getting information to support diagnosis of other cognitive disorders, the MRI could be really, really helpful. And it's one of our bread and butter diagnostic tests.
Let's get into the types of memory loss. Can you talk about the most common ones you see? And, you know, a lot of people, they become familiar with it probably through the media, right? So they hear about people like Bruce Willis or Wendy Williams developing dementia and focus in on that. But can you talk in generalities the more common diagnoses you see in clinic and how you differentiate those?
Yeah, so what I first off like to do is provide a lot of education on definitions and terms. I get asked the question pretty often, which one's worse, dementia or Alzheimer's? And I find myself having to define these terms. So dementia is a syndrome, and it really means that we have now become so cognitively impaired that we've lost independence in our daily activities. So we need assistance with a lot of different aspects of daily living. And Alzheimer's disease is a disease. It's one of the causes of dementia, and it's the most common cause. So 80% of cases of dementia are attributable to Alzheimer's disease. The remaining 20%, this is where you'd find the Bruce Willis and the, you know, Wendy Williams, the frontotemporal dementia. That's the cause of their diseases, right? And then there's also vascular dementia, where people may have had some significant blood vessel changes in their brain, or even have had a really massive stroke, massive enough to affect their memory and other parts of cognition, resulting in them not being able to care for themselves anymore. So that definition, just understanding that dementia is a syndrome and it's the outcome of certain disease processes, is where I like to start.
When we look at the frontotemporal dementia, typically that's a beginning of Alzheimer's disease. For our listeners, can you just define Alzheimer's disease? Because I think the term is thrown around a lot more than it specifically applies.
Yeah, it's thrown around very loosely, and it's used interchangeably with other terms, and it tends to be a little bit messy and incorrect. Alzheimer's disease actually refers to a specific pathology that's caused by the buildup of amyloid plaque in the brain, as well as something called neurofibrillary tangles. So we all produce this protein. It's called the amyloid precursor protein. And typically we clear it. But unfortunately, in some cases, people are unable to clear this protein, and it starts to build up and form these plaques on the brain, and then it causes neurodegeneration, and that's when we start to see these cognitive symptoms of memory loss, sometimes even language impairment and perceptual disturbances and things of that nature.
So the beta amyloid, first of all, the discovery of beta amyloid is fairly recent. I mean, we always knew there were plaques and tangles, but when did we become more aware of beta amyloid? Because it's key as the target for treatment as well.
Yes, yes. Within recent years, and, you know, over the last, I want to say at least 5 years, they've been working on these treatments to target the amyloid to slow down the accumulation of these plaques. And just to kind of segue into the treatments that we have lately, they are called monoclonal antibodies. And there are two types right now that are FDA approved for targeting these amyloid plaques. And the first one is lecanemab. And the second one that was more recently approved, it's called donanemab. And the way that they work is that it's given by IV infusion, and they remove the amyloid plaque that's accumulating on the brain, which is the underlying cause of Alzheimer's disease. And it slows the progression of the disease down.
Now, many clinics backed off on lecanemab when it first came out. Are you using these monoclonal antibodies in your clinic now?
Yes, we are. We just started getting donanemab set up on formulary. Right now, we are actively infusing patients with lecanemab. Now, there's been some apprehension with a lot of clinics over time because of the potential side effects with the monoclonal antibodies, and it's something called ARIA, which stands for amyloid-related imaging abnormalities. And the way I like to describe it to my patients is kind of like if you have a scab. If you pick at that scab, there are two things that could potentially happen. It could swell or it could bleed. And it's the same thing with the plaques, right? So the medication is going in there and it's removing the plaques. So there is a potential for swelling and bleeding, which is ARIA-E and ARIA-H. Now, one of the ways that we try to mitigate for this risk is by doing genetic testing. And there is a special test that we do, and we found based on the studies, if someone is positive for this particular gene, the risk is a little bit higher for these potential side effects. And what that means is that it doesn't mean that you cannot get the medication. It just means that we have to monitor a lot closely to make sure that if these symptoms do develop, we follow proper protocol.
So when you get the infusion, I think it's a weekly infusion, isn't it? Or what is the
given
protocol?
Every 2 weeks. Yeah.
Every 2 weeks.
You're getting it once every 2 weeks, yes. And we also do serial MRIs. So at certain points, you do a repeat MRI, because what happens is sometimes ARIA could be asymptomatic. So your patient may not have any symptoms, but you can pick it up on imaging. And based on the studies, what they found is that, at least for lecanemab, the first, I want to say, five sessions is where they found the most cases of ARIA occurring. So typically before the fifth infusion, we'd have a repeat MRI to see if we do see any signs of bleeding or swelling and things of that nature. But that one's given once every 2 weeks. And then with donanemab, that one's given once a month.
Okay. So let me ask you a frank question. I mean, we've seen the data. What's your impression? Does it work?
To be determined.
Okay. All right. So, listen, we like to be frank on this program, okay? So,
yeah.
What is your initial impression?
So, for what I've been seeing so far, so I have roughly 35 patients that are getting the medication, and it's pretty early on in the game, right? So based on the studies, what they've shown is that people tend to kind of like stabilize by the 6 month mark, because you're doing this for almost 18 months. And what I've seen so far, thankfully so far, patients have been tolerating the medication okay. We've been seeing some little spurts here and there of confusion, which is to be expected. It's an expected side effect of the medicine. I have not had patients at that halfway mark yet to really say in real time whether or not they've stabilized yet. So that's why I said to be determined.
So one of the things with most treatments, and I think it applies here, is the earlier you intervene, the better off you are. Is that the case with both of these monoclonal antibodies?
Yes, definitely. In fact, they are FDA approved only for mild cognitive impairment due to Alzheimer's disease and mild dementia due to Alzheimer's disease. So if you have a patient with moderate dementia or severe dementia, that medication would not be a good fit for them. So the intervention is typically best in the earlier stages.
So I assume that that's because of the beta amyloid load. So there's too much beta amyloid, it's really too much to clean up.
Exactly.
So let's take a step backward. You talked about mild cognitive impairment. Let's talk about that diagnosis because, again, I know a lot of people use the MoCA and the mini mental status exam. Are those fairly helpful or indicative of people who have MCI, mild cognitive impairment?
They can be helpful. It should not be diagnostic. And I like to stress the importance of that because what happens is these little screening tests, they do not take into account the most important things such as cultural differences. Some people may not have had formal education and that can impact their score. Language barriers, right? Also people who have different abilities. So the screening tests, they tend to have these little things that you have to draw, the clock or the cube or things like that, and it doesn't really take into account patients who may be visually impaired, right? However, it really could be a helpful tool. Now, the key to really diagnosing someone with mild cognitive impairment is really understanding, once again, the activities of daily living and whether or not that is affected, right? So that is what differentiates someone from having mild cognitive impairment versus dementia. And looking at the overall score on the screening test can be helpful in diagnosing mild cognitive impairment, but you also have to use your clinical judgment and may have to use neuropsychometric testing, neuropsychological testing, as they are more equipped to deal with patients that may have some cultural differences or language barriers and the other different abilities that I had mentioned.
Now, in terms of alternative treatments, are you still using Aricept and the other medications?
Namenda.
Are those still being used?
They are. I mean, they've been on the market for like a couple of decades now. And, you know, there is some utility. I do like to manage expectations when I do prescribe these medications because it really could be a hit or miss. So with Aricept, which is also known as donepezil, the indication for that is mild, moderate, and severe Alzheimer's disease. Dementia, that is. It's not FDA approved for mild cognitive impairment due to Alzheimer's disease, but some people use it off-label. And we also have this off-label usage of Aricept for vascular dementia as well, too. Where I've found it to be really helpful in my experience is when people have more overt symptoms of dementia. So a lot of times you may see patients coming in with some irritability, agitation, even perceptual disturbances like illusions and hallucinations. I tend to find that patients respond better to donepezil and any of the cholinesterase inhibitors because it truly is that derangement in the cholinergic system in the brain, right? So it still has its place. Now, it doesn't reverse things. Technically, it doesn't really slow things down because it's not really attacking the underlying cause, which is the, you know, beta amyloid. But it does have its place in providing some kind of support cognitively in our patient populations.
I have a question here, and I think it emphasizes, this is a good one from Patricia, because it emphasizes kind of the overlap between your field and that of movement disorders, right? Mm-hmm. So we hear about Lewy body dementia. This question is, I have a family member who has cortical basilar dementia.
Mm-hmm.
What can we expect regarding the outcome of cortical basilar dementia. Maybe you could talk a little bit about not just cortical basilar, but maybe Lewy body as well.
Yeah, so, you know, the way I like to conceptualize cognitive disorders is you have cognitive disorders without motor symptoms, and then you have cognitive disorders with, right? So the ones without motor symptoms would be things like the Alzheimer's disease, maybe even vascular dementia, and some types of frontotemporal dementias. The ones with motor symptoms would be things like Parkinson's disease dementia and Lewy body disease. They fall under the same category because they're caused by the same pathology, which is the alpha-synuclein protein. And then there is the corticobasal syndromes, right, where you could have like this tauopathy. Tau is the underlying protein that's affected there. And unfortunately, there is not as much medical support or medications in general for these disorders, especially the corticobasal degenerative diseases. And what we tend to see is that over a span of like 7 to 10 years, sometimes even 5 to 7 years, unfortunately, patients tend to decline rapidly. But they've always the anomaly to the rule. So, you know, you never know. Some people might decline a little bit slower than the expected 5 to 7 year range.
With the frontotemporal dementias, a lot of people present first with aphasias. Can you talk a little bit about that presentation of patient who have been misdiagnosed in many cases, to be honest with you, as you know, that it's not a real syndrome when they present with these aphasias? Can you talk a little bit about that and the misdiagnosis of these folks?
Yeah, so with frontotemporal dementia, it's known as FTD for short. There's two versions. Well, there's multiple versions, but the main ones would be the language variant and then the behavioral variant. So most people are more versed with or accustomed to the behavioral variant, where people have these drastic personality changes. They end up being hyperoral, so they're eating a lot more. They have an increase in the sweet tooth. There's some hypersexuality, really strange disinhibited behaviors. And then there is the language variant, of which there are two types. So there is a semantic variant, and then there is this agrammatic variant, right? So what we tend to see in patients with the agrammatic language variant of FTD, which is also known as primary progressive aphasia, is that they have difficulties with fluency of language. So there's a lot of challenges with really having a good sentence. You know, the syntax is affected, and it's a lot of effort involved in really getting that speech out there. And then you have the semantic variant, where people are able to communicate very clearly, but single word comprehension and finding certain names for things tends to be more of a problem. So what we tend to see, and what helps to differentiate this language variant, FTD, is acknowledging that memory is typically spared. So I think that's one way to help clinicians try to avoid misdiagnosing patients, really looking into the fact that the memory is preserved and the language is the area of cognition that's most affected.
You know, a lot of our listeners are listening to this and saying, okay, so what do I do? How do I stay out of Dr. Smith's clinic? What are the things I should be doing in my lifestyle at any age, at middle age or an older age, to avoid dementia if I can? Can you go right over some of those factors?
Oh, yeah, definitely. So, you know, we have what are things that are called modifiable risk factors, and then we have non-modifiable risk factors, right? So I like to tell my patients we can only control the things that we can. And the modifiable things would be Diets. It's something you hear all the time. It's so important. I typically recommend the Mediterranean diet. That is one that's rich in poultry, vegetables, fruits, nuts, shellfish, and very little red meat. What we found is that the key to really keeping a healthy brain is making sure that you're vascular system is intact, right? So if we could have a healthy diet to decrease that risk, these vascular risk factors, that would be a great place to start. Exercising sounds really generic, but it really is so important and has such utility in memory. And also socializing, that's a really huge piece. What happens as we get older is our social circles do get smaller because we do lose people. And with that, we're not interacting as much. And you know that typical saying, if you don't use it, you lose it. It really does apply to this as well, too. Now, the non-modifiable risk factors, you know, we can't help how we're made genetically, and we can't help some things happening. All of us, we're human, and we're not exempt from having things like this happen to us, right? So what we found, risk factors for specifically Alzheimer's disease would be female, being female, right? And it's thought to be because typically females tend to live longer than males, so we just tend to see Alzheimer's a lot more commonly in females for that reason. Being over the age of 65 is a risk factor. If we were to look at genetics, which I don't want to focus on too much because we don't want people running out really trying to get genetic testing unnecessarily. But what we found is there is a specific gene. It's called the APOE gene. And APOE4, people who possess one or two copies of that gene, they are at increased risk for Alzheimer's disease. It doesn't mean that they will get it, but it just means in comparison to people who do not have that gene, they're at increased risk. But we do have patients who do not have that gene, and they still develop Alzheimer's disease. So that's why I said, you know, taking caution and not worrying about getting genetic testing for that particularly, great, I wouldn't encourage it.
Quick question for you. Just came in. Michael said, we see these TV commercials for things like Prevagen or Reva or whatever. Do they work or not?
It breaks my heart every time I hear about Prevagen because there's no scientific evidence to support that Prevagen is helpful. Now, I believe there is like a tiny little disclaimer on the box that basically says that this medication is not intended to treat cognitive disorders. And like I said, there's no evidence to support that it's helpful at all.
Thank you.
And when it comes to Nareva, Nareva is basically a combination of some vitamin Bs, right? And that is something that could be helpful only if the underlying cause is a vitamin B deficiency. So one of the tests that we do when patients come to my clinic is we check for vitamin B12. And if somebody has like a history of alcohol use disorder or an eating disorder, anything that might make them deficient in thiamine, we would do a vitamin B1 level as well, too. Now, people who are deficient in these vitamins and it coincides with cognitive change, they would be the ones to benefit from Nareva and vitamin B12 and B1 supplementation.
Charis, thank you. Thank you for your time today. Thank you for being so direct with such great information for our listeners. And I want to remind everybody, if you wish to contact Dr. Smith or get into the Memory Care Center, the phone number is 860-545-7550. Thanks again, Charis, and especially thank you for everything you do for our community.
Well, thanks for having me.
Many thanks to Kevin Corza. He's been on the board today. Jeff Chandler's in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. Next week, we will be back with a live program. If you missed any part of today's program, you can download the Healthy Rounds podcast and really get some great information on memory loss from Dr. Charis Smith. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by Hartford HealthCare, Rochford Eye Center, St. Francis Hospital, Covaris, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com. Till then, stay well.